Hello, big boys and girls, parents and grandparents, and everyone interested in AI and robotics. I'm Anastasia, an AI professor and entrepreneur, and I'm bringing to your attention AI Snacks with Romy and Robbie, a podcast for AI muggles, not wizards. My show translates AI and robotic technologies from difficult to easy to understand. Today, we are going to deep dive for multimodal AI. Multimodal AI is a form of AI that processes and integrates multiple types of data, such as text, images, video, and audio. And this is important to generate content, form insights, and make predictions. Multimodal AIs lead to a more comprehensive perception of the world around us, of the reality in machines. Quite often on this podcast, I'm talking how the machines and AIs don't truly understand the world the way humans or cats do. And there's another subject which is quite close to getting machines to perceive the world in a much more comprehensive way. And this is about how neuroscience and research of human brain influences the development of AI and robotic technologies. We will hear about a fascinating subject such as sleep algorithms and what they do for neural networks. And finally, there's a very interesting question. Will embodiment of AI lead to a better understanding of the reality in machines? I am bringing an amazing guest, and this is a data scientist, Dimitri Fischer. He lives in San Diego, and he holds a PhD in plasma and high-temperature physics from Weizmann Institute of Science. Dimitri has extensive experience in artificial intelligence. He's very skilled in multimodal AI and in computer vision technologies. Dimitri was senior scientist at Brain Corporation, and he did postdoctoral research at UC Davis. Enjoy the show. So I am joined in the studio by Dimitri Fischer, and he's a veteran in artificial intelligence and in computer vision. So Dimitri, could you please talk a little bit about what do you do and how did you get to where you are today?
Sure, Anastasia. It's first of all, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you. And I am a head of data science at Acadium. So I work on artificial intelligence and machine learning. We work on problems in multimodal domains, so combining language, images, videos, sometimes other modalities or sensors, and primarily to solve problems for other businesses, other companies, especially problems that pertain to computer vision, industrial computer vision, but we use multimodal technologies combining images and language and sometimes other modalities as well.
Please just, not to interrupt you, but my audience is not technically savvy, and multimodal So those models which are capable to combine multiple sources of information, they're still quite new, right? Could you maybe talk a little bit how they evolved and how did you get into this space?
Oh, of course. So by training, I'm a physicist. So I was working in physics, and then I kind of drifted gradually into neuroscience, and then I drifted gradually into artificial intelligence. But really, these are not pivots or not big changes, because like as long as I remember myself, I was trying to figure out how things work, especially how living or behaving things work. And all of my work was about using computers and using theory to figure out exactly that. So between physics and neuroscience and machine learning or artificial intelligence, it's really very, very close. It's not that far of a leap at all. So, And many people did follow the same path as me. I mean, I know many people who went from physics to neuroscience to machine learning.
I love physicists as AI scientists, by the way. There were a couple of those at Dun & Bradstreet. And we had the best of the time because they were really capable not just to apply what is already there from the libraries, but develop new algorithms and solve problems manually. It was a huge treat to observe how they worked.
Thank you. Yeah. And some of the founders of the computational neuroscience machine learning sort of symbiosis, they come from physics. So, yeah. So that's that.
And what is multimodal AI and how advanced is it today?
So this is actually a fascinating subject because think about it. When we see chicken, hear a chicken, smell a chicken, we have a notion or concept of a chicken, and it doesn't matter what senses we receive that information through. So in our mind, the concepts, the understanding, the notions do not depend on specific sensory modality, do not depend on whether we see it, hear it, smell it, touch it. It's still the same. Even a person who doesn't have a sense of smell, I have a very poor one, but I know people who don't have a sense of smell at all, or people who cannot hear. I mean, they still know full well what a chicken are. I mean, a person who's blind from birth would still, God forbid, still would know full well what a chicken is and would be able to take care of them. I know they do. So the point being that sufficiently advanced neural networks should not be restricted to one type of input or one sensory input, unless you're building a neural network that serves a very particular purpose. But if you're talking about a neural network that has to interact with its environment, like a brain of a robot in a sense, or an intelligent assistant, the best approach there is to combine the ability to process and combine different types of inputs. Like you probably everyone at this point, or most people at this point, has seen models that can combine image and text. So you can give a textual prompt and it will generate an image, or you can give it an image and it will generate a textual description of it, or find objects, familiar objects in it. So this is an example of a multimodal neural network that combine image input and text input, or is capable of understanding, quote unquote, both images and text. I mean, the better word is processing, not understanding, because that's a bit charged word, but
that's true. And by the way, we truly use kind of, you know, human words and human language while talking about AIs. And even when I shoot my short videos, like 60 to 90 seconds, I'm saying like machine understands. Frankly, it doesn't, right? And it's interesting, those multimodal AIs, they combined different inputs just like humans, but they don't have an inborn mental model of something like a chicken. So obviously a baby will know what a cat is at some point in time, right? And even if, let's say, a cat on an image is upside down or lacks, let's say, a paw, a human baby will immediately recognize this animal. For computers, it needs to be trained and trained and trained. And I wonder whether there is an expectation that multimodal AIs would enable better generalization for AIs. How do you think about it?
That's an excellent, a great question. Better generalization is a bit of a lower hanging fruit than true intelligence or true understanding and true behavior. better generalization if it can be achieved there is a work still to be done there. I'm trying to go as non-technical as possible. So you see me talking slowly. But the much harder problem is to actually make it behave, because current models, even multimodal foundation models, multimodal models or large vision language models, they are just capable of manipulating images and text as items, as numbers. They do not have any real life experience in a sense. They're not embodied. They don't have they don't experience cause and consequence. They don't know what the consequence of their action is. They don't know good and evil. They don't behave in a natural sense. And this is the next big step in artificial intelligence, to actually embody these systems, to enable them to function as assistants, as household robots, as industrial robots, as autonomous vehicles, as behaving entities. So give them the ability to interact with their environment. And robotics right now is not based on these models, not yet, but I see a lot of effort in this direction, trying, because that's the next, that's imperative to make these systems truly aware. Because right now they're not self-aware. They're not really aware at all.
Yeah. And I just wonder, because, you know, I speak on this podcast about deep learning, and, you know, so much progress in AI is on behalf of deep learning. And, you know, of course, we can celebrate so many things, but I just wonder whether common deep learning architectures, even if we have like multi-layered neural networks with, you know, everything which is a contemporary architecture, like transformer architecture, still there are weaknesses. And there was a case, I think it was February 23, when an amateur Go player smashed Kata Go in a Go match. And this was because the AI handled the stats, cranked numbers, but did not understand the concept of a group. So the group of the stone. And once the player got it, it outmaneuvered this AI. And this is because this AI was not capable to achieve a so-called distribution shift and move into, let's say, another dimension of comprehending what was going on. Obviously, this AI did not know it was playing a board game. I mean, it was just going through patterns and providing some answers. I'm wondering whether... So this multimodal inclusion of sensoric might enable AIs to be better with this distribution shift. I don't know. Please educate me. And are we still kind of, you know, in this domain of deep learning, or are we going to infuse other AIs like symbolistic AI? I don't know. So maybe you could talk a little bit about it, like, you know, hybrid models, not just what we perceive to be deep learning in the classical sense.
Yes, there are several really good, really deep thoughts in there. And let me try to address them one by one.
Please.
So for board games, DeepMind have trained more than one, but that they have the the AI that's specifically trained to play Go, to play this board game in a. And that they used a very particular, very interesting type of training to achieve that. that beats that has beat human champion. But that is still not. It's an automaton. The real games, when you observe chess players, there's psychology involved, and machine is not capable of that. Like when they see each other, they see where their gaze is focused. They see the expression of each other's face. They see, and that is not mapped into the actual pattern of moves, like that you can read online afterwards. The real thing sort of happens in their mind, in their brain, and this is not something that an automaton can. I mean, it doesn't. The automaton just receives a board as some kind of, we call it embedding, but it's really just numbers that describe how the board is set.
Yes. Or
the history of last moves in Go, it's actually, it matters what the previous move was, because that dictates whether some moves are possible or not. But the point being, an AI playing Go only sees the board. C is just only receives a set of numbers that describes the moves. That describes the board and the moves. It doesn't see the other player. It doesn't have any notion of another other player. It just receives the next move of the other player and then finds the best, the optimal from its standpoint continuation. It looks several moves ahead, of course, but in Go it's complicated because there's a lot of options on every step. So that's that. But the deeper point being, the multimodal AIs, even the multimodal AIs, still they see images and text and sense and other sense input from, let's say, sensors like temperature or pressure or whatnot as a series of numbers. They don't have. And then they find the right output, the right output series of numbers for the current and previous input series of numbers. That's what they do. They don't have the,
mental models.
They don't have the behaviors in the same sense that the humans or animals do. But they can be trained in somewhat of the same way. So if we use, let's say, operant conditioning on an animal, we're rewarded for a good behavior, or we withhold reward for a bad behavior, you can do the same with neural networks. You can train them the same way, but it still doesn't mean that they have... That's just a way to optimize that output number. It doesn't mean they have any kind of mental model of the outside world. And that is imperative. That's exactly why we need to embody these models and enable them to perceive, to be self-aware, or at least to be aware of their environment and of the effect that they have on their environment. To close the loop.
Yeah.
So the outcome of their action would then come back as a sensory input of how they have modified their environment in the real environment, not in a board game. Because within a board game, it's a very, very constrained. It's a very constrained set of rules or set of possibilities. Even if there are many, they're all of the same kind. And this is where we get to this out of distribution problem, the other problem that you mentioned.
Yeah.
So in the real world, and this is why it's so hard, this is why we have this really superhuman performance on very specific, very constrained tasks, but we don't have robots that perform even to the level of a 2 or 3 year old in the real world, because the real world is so poorly constrained. There's so many things that can happen or may happen, and the robot will never encounter many of those in in the, humans don't encounter many of those in their lifetime, but humans have evolved. Humans and primates before that, and all the way to what was 2 billion years ago, we had plenty of time to have some of these things, as you mentioned, pre-wired or pre-coded in our DNA or in epigenetic stuff. I'm not. Yeah, that's probably a whole separate discussion, but. The point being, and look at the, let's say, butterfly.
Yes.
Butterfly doesn't know its parents. It just, there's an egg and then a caterpillar and then a chrysalis and then the butterfly comes out. It never meets its parents, or if it does, it would never recognize them. It doesn't know. But it has all these behaviors in it already. It doesn't need to learn what a flower is, and it doesn't need to learn what a bird is that wants to catch it, or a spider is. It knows. It knows to avoid dangers. It knows to which plants are good for it to lay the eggs on, and which plants are not good to lay its eggs on, and what a plant is. So these things evolved. There is, so that robots cannot have, but they have something we don't. They can learn from each other's experience. That's called federated learning.
Yes.
So if one robot acquires a skill, then all of the other robots can acquire the same skill under certain conditions, not always, but under certain conditions, we can set it up in such a way that the skill acquired or, piece of learning acquired by one robot will be shared among all the robots. That they can do, and we cannot. They can also split their attention to many things at once. We cannot. We can only pay attention to one thing at a time. But some neural networks can, and most robots, even today's autonomous vehicles or some types of robots can split their attention to multiple things at once, or to multiple regions of space at once. Yes, robots can do that. You had an excellent explanation on one of the previous blogs of how a transformer network can split its attention with the color markers or underlines.
Yes.
That was really cool, by the way. Yeah.
Thank you.
Way more intuitive explanation than I would have come up with.
Thank you. No, it's all in the book. By the way, you know, when you talk about what kind of, you know, we humans can do, but then you mentioned butterflies, and I was thinking, so this federated learning and kind of, you know, distributed information and capturing this pieces of information throughout the network of robots. Yes. And then I was thinking about bees. I mean, those insects, it's not just one single bee, which is an intelligent being, but the whole colony of bees are intelligent. And somehow, you know, they are algorithms influenced by behaviors of such insects, right? Yes. Like, yes. Bees. Does it play any role in developing federative learning and robotics?
Historically, it did, yes. Historically, it did. Not right now, but bees are among all the insects. Bees could be the most intelligent, and that they have on order of a million neurons. Most have fewer. And also, yeah. Keep in mind that in insects or in arthropods in general, each neuron is not like a human neuron that has a body that has to respond to all the inputs it receives and then generate one output. In insects or in arthropods, different parts of a single neuron can behave far more independently than they do in our brain. So their brain is built differently.
It's interesting, but there is this 1,000 brain theory, right? said, though, that it's not just like one neuron with all the connections, which is kind of, you know, spiking and responding to some impulses, but like they are a thousand and thousands, which then kind of, you know, compare the notes, if I may say, and vote what is probably the best outcome. So, for example, if I have a cup here and obviously, you know, if I do like I kind of, you know, glide my finger and it's all smooth, so there are no cracks. So my neurons are not spiking because everything is as they expect it to be. But if there is some sharp crack and my finger notices it, then neurons will spike and kind of, you know, what is going on? So is it still a cup or is it something else? So they will kind of, you know, compare notes and decide what is in front of them. So it's how is it comparable what bees are doing with a very different brain architecture and what humans are doing with, you know, this voting mechanisms in our brain?
Yes. There's still a lot of commonality at that level, because it would be very inefficient for a brain or for a neural network to encode the information that's highly predictable, to encode something that is highly predictable, because there's information, but there's no new information in it.
Yeah.
Like it is already known. So most neural networks, I mean, most biological neural networks, and that's been known for a while, but is still being actively researched, they mostly encode the something that's related to surprisal. The new, or it's a bit of an old term in neuroscience, but it's still very much in use. So something that is not expected from the previous sensory inputs. And in humans, that corresponds to bottom-up attention, so-called. So something unexpected will always draw our attention, the focus of our mind to it, whether it's truly something important, or it could be, sometimes it's a false alarm, so to speak, but and then the attention will wander elsewhere or return to where it was. But this is behaviorally extremely important. This is from the very, very early animals. This was a mechanism to detect predators, because predators, in machine learning, we call it adversarial training, but in real life, a predator would try to approach the prey unnoticed.
Yes.
And then the prey would try to notice or to detect the predator before the predator has an opportunity to pounce or to attack the prey. So, and this sort of arms race gives rise to improvements in neural networks. And the same is done also with artificial neural networks. That's called adversarial training. Oftentimes that is used.
This is so awesome. And you brought me into very new thinking about actually how embodiment of AIs might improve the very functionality of neural networks, how multimodal AI could improve the functionalities of those neural networks, and how those both things could help with distribution shift problem and generalization. I have a question. So there is an episode in my book when Robbie, the android, gets damaged.
Oh.
And then so there's a thriller element. So I know that you haven't finished the reading, but
no.
In the third part, so Robbie is really damaged and he's in a lab and people try to revive him, so repair him. And then he's up. So his hardware is working, but software not so much. He goes through this catastrophic forgetting. So he forgot many, many things. I wonder whether this multimodal AIs could improve the issue of catastrophic forgetting. But before we discuss it, could you maybe define catastrophic forgetting for a non-technical audience? What is going on there?
I'll try. Like, The simplest way you can think of catastrophic forgetting, if you imagine a whiteboard, so when you give a lecture, you fill it out with knowledge, but then the class ends, and before the next class begins, the whiteboard is wiped clean. So yeah. If the whiteboard was the robot's knowledge or memory or neural network that enables the robot to function, that would be the catastrophic forgetting. When you give it a new lesson, it forgets all the old ones. So it's like a whiteboard. Now, in real life, there are many ways that this is prevented. But in neural networks, there are two main ways to prevent catastrophic forgetting. One of them is in artificial neural networks. One of them is to replay or rehearse the something that's been already learned, so that they can sort of interleave or the old learning with a new one, so the old one is not forgotten. And the other one is to design the networks in such a way that they have enough memory capacity or enough learning capacity, and furthermore that the new learning only alters them as little as necessary and doesn't interfere or doesn't mess up with the same things that maintain the knowledge of what has been already learned. And catastrophic forgetting in artificial neural networks is sometimes called catastrophic interference. This is why it's called this.
And is in my book, How Robot Remembers, he uses the reference point, and the reference point is not just one single piece of data, but it's a cat. So because the robot experienced the world with the cat, through the cat, he walked first on four instead of two legs. So you seeing Romy the cat and remembering brings his skills back. I wonder, could those multimodal capabilities improve the issue of catastrophic forgetting, or is it something completely out of space and different?
They may. That is largely an unresearched. That's largely, maybe for our younger listeners, that would be what they would be working on, because that's not solved yet. That's largely unsolved. What is kind of the algorithm? It is. So one of the ways in the humans, I mentioned replay or rehearsal of the information. One of the ways that human memory is consolidated is during sleep.
Yes.
Because we dream or we think of something we experienced. And there are algorithms like that also for neural networks. There are some really old, they call wake-sleep algorithms, and there are newer ones, the sleep algorithms, this is very active area of research. So that's one thing. The other thing you mentioned that's very important is association.
Yes.
No, or sometimes we say in neuroscience, or in AI, we say pattern completion. That's part of what association is. A lot of how our brain works is by associating what has been learned previously with the new things, or by associating different aspects of what has learned together to form a more complete internal representation or kind of our mind picture of the outside world. And that is a very powerful way of learning or recording things for oneself. This is one of the fundamental principle of how neural networks function. And I'm saying this very, very generally. It's almost any kind of neural network, artificial or biological, is the association between previously learned or known things and the new things that is, or association between representations of different things, objects, actions, whatever they are, is essentially how things work. And that was realized in more than 100 years ago. I mean, if you think of Pavlov and of classical conditioning, that exactly shows that.
Yes. I mean, it's just so mesmerizing how much we learn in technology and mathematics when we look into neuroscience, right? And how much there is a cross-population between neuroscience and AI. If you would kind of, you know, crystallize major trends, how neuroscience influences AI, what trends would you name?
I mean, fundamentally, the artificial intelligence, I mean, the word intelligence kind of points to human or animal intelligence, right? So it's intelligence, but artificial. So it's trying to reproduce the human or animal skills or capabilities or behaviors or abilities by artificial means. And even now that on some tasks, the artificial neural networks do better than humans, we definitely still take inspiration from human intelligence and animal intelligence in trying to implement better networks that are learned quicker, that don't need as much data, and then the next steps, as I said, embodied networks that can actually behave, that can meaningfully interact with their environment. The unsolved problems, we already touched on a few, but the really big unsolved problem, and that will take a while to solve, is actually a problem of common sense.
Yeah.
Because this is so hard to define what it is. It's exactly being able to behave. You mentioned out of distribution. It's related. It's being able to generate the appropriate output under novel conditions. But what are novel conditions? It can be anything, literally. So this is why it's so hard. But if the environment is completely random, it completely unstructured, just truly random, then there is no predictability. So then there is no good behavior. But our world is not completely random, and that's the beauty of it. We can't predict what's going to happen most of the time, or at least for a short period. Sometimes for longer periods of time. Sometimes for shorter periods of time, depends on what exactly it is. But the robots can predict, if you give it a sequence of numbers or several sequences of numbers, it would be able to predict. But if you embody a multimodal neural network that we have right now in a robot and let it out in the world, it would not yet behave properly, would certainly not have a common sense. And this is the really big topic of research that for our listeners, I mean, there will be plenty to explore and to research for them and for their children.
Yes.
And this is one of those areas that will be researched for decades or possibly centuries to come. That's for sure. Because this is such a broad area. I mean, we can define it very concisely in words, because we know it when we see it, like the right behavior and the wrong behavior. We can tell right away. But that took 2 billion years to evolve, and it took for each of us, 20 years of going to, like, learning from our parents and in kindergarten and school and in college. So by the age of 20, we kind of have a common sense, or so we hope.
It's disputable, probably, for many educators who are listening. And I was just smiling when you were talking about common sense, because, you know, I talk to my audience about how computers understand the world, and it's all about representations. And what does it mean, representation? Because obviously, you know, they have those kind of matrices of numbers, right? And mm-hmm. I was like thinking, okay, let's dissect. What is common in representation and what is sense?
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
And we already have a multimodal issue.
Yep.
Yes. And by the way, thank you so much for mentioning sleep, which is a huge concept. And I mean, there are tons of books today about sleep and sleep mm-hmm. research and how important sleep is just for biological organisms. And by the way, in my book, it's called Romy, Robbie, and the Secrets of Sleep, because this very Robbie is being revived with the help of sleep algorithms, which mm-hmm. are, yeah. To a major extent, the IP of people at the University of San Diego. So,
we have quite a bit of research on that at UCSD. Yes.
Very fascinating. Just, you know, Dmitry, I mean, thank you so much. You're giving so many wonderful impulses and content. Just my last question for you. So, you know, we are talking about, like, AI mimicking human intelligence and forecasting capabilities and the abilities to perceive the world and to problem solve. But, I mean, because AI have so many more capabilities to integrate what is not human. It can learn from dolphins. It can learn from spiders and from bees. So, you know, all the creatures which might inspire development of technology. So, they might be more perception that what humans are capable of, and more listening and more understanding at some point in time. How do you think about researching different creatures, biological creatures, and applying findings of this research in developing robotics and AIs?
That is actually happening. That is quite an active area of research. I mean, a lot of living organisms, they can see in the ultraviolet, or see in a broad sense in the infrared wavelengths, or perceive polarization of light, or perceive the magnetic, kind of have a built-in compass of sorts. So, perceive the magnetic field and the orientation of the sun and the end of the magnetic field relative to the horizon. So that's one thing, and certainly the ability to very accurately perceive that is something that the robots and even robots for exploring other planets that they do use. They always, like, if you think of starships, they always or spaceships, they always orient themselves to the stars and use very accurate measurement of the acceleration of the magnetic field and of other things around them, something that humans cannot sense, but the artificial system certainly can. And this is how they stabilize themselves, orient themselves. And there is a very, sort of very primitive, but still element of behavior in those systems. And we don't think of them as living things because they're engineered. And they're engineered out of metal, not out of living tissue. But they actually do have behaviors, because once you get far enough from the Earth, the time it takes for the signal to travel, it's too long to respond for a human to respond in time.
Yeah.
So they have to make their own decisions. It's just otherwise it will be too late. And some of these algorithms are to some extent nature inspired. So there is an element of behavior in that, very simple behavior, but behavior. So that especially the motor control, like how the movements are generated and how there is feedback in that. There is prediction of what the right movement is just purely in their quote unquote mind. And then there is a slower feedback loop through the actual environment, like what I asked my front right wheel to spin so much to move forward. Now, did I actually move forward? So there are at least two levels of predictions there. A, what would be the expected outcome of the action? And then what is the measure of unexpectedness in the actual outcome?
Yes.
And we're getting back to what we already discussed a little bit, but this is the actual behavior of a non-living thing, which is very much inspired by the behavior of how movement is generated in living things. Like if you think of the cup that you were just using as an example, we expect it to be full, so when we lift, but when we lift and we feel with our muscle that it's not as full as we expected it to be, or it's not as heavy as we expected it to be, that's the surprise, though. We feel it right away. Oh, something's amiss. Yeah. And then our muscles, even before we consciously react, they stabilize it so it doesn't fly off.
Yes. And what would you say to people who are actually afraid of machines which are equipped of senses and capabilities which are far away from what we are used to in our messy but still human life?
Well, I mean, people are not optimal in a sense that novel things, they don't only arouse, like the surprise, though, it also comes with fear, because we yes. are, I mean, if we, it's built in evolutionary. Think of a rabbit or of a bunny.
Yeah.
Like if it perceives something novel, something unexpected, it should first of all be afraid of it because it may be a predator.
Yeah.
If it's not a predator, okay, so it just wasn't chewing on the grass for 30 seconds. That's not that big of a loss. But if it missed a predator, then it's done for.
Yeah.
So that's why it's surprisal in living things is usually associated with fear. Now, we are conscious being. We have our awareness, and so we know that the new things should not be feared, but we still instinctively fear them. Our ancestors used to fear the fire. Our ancestors, before we learned to harness it, to cook food and to move ourselves and to produce electricity. And then our ancestors, some of them at least, were afraid of mirrors because they thought the mirror would steal your soul. And it took a while to get over that. Or afraid of photographs, again, because they thought that the photograph will
cap your
soul. Yeah, pull you in somehow. These are irrational fears of anything novel or of. And these are the same fears that unfortunately drive xenophobia or racism. Yeah. But this is kind of a negative baggage of evolutionary baggage. Now, not all of the evolutionary baggage is good. I mean, some of it is bad. And this is the example of the bad. But we as we are intelligent enough and sentient enough to overcome that fear and to know that artificial beings, the AIs, the robots, they are here to help us, and they are already helping us. And they're here to help us even more and to make our lives nicer. And that fear is irrational. We need to be to realize that fear is irrational and to fight it.
Dmitry, actually, this is a wonderful conclusion to this episode of my podcast. Thank you so much for your time. And actually, the remedy is in communicating and in translating something which might be perceived as difficult into a normal human language. And this is what we've done in the past 40 minutes. So thank you once again for your time.
And
dear listeners, before we meet again next week, please consider visiting my website, www.romyandroby.ai. And I have now an Instagram account, and I post short videos explaining AI and robotics in just 60 seconds. The Instagram account is Romy and Roby. Thank you. Till the next week, and bye-bye.